You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Bible for Normal People podcast, another solo episode. And the topic today is evangelicals and the problem of the Old Testament. Now, a couple things right off the bat. First of all, this is the subtitle to one of my books called Inspiration and Incarnation, which I wrote in 2005. And there was a 10th anniversary edition that came out in 2015. And you know, it's the issues in that book that keep coming up. You know, some of the things I address there are ones that I keep getting asked about by people. And so I thought it'd be a good idea to do a podcast about some of these issues and some others that keep causing cognitive dissonance and actually a lot of pain for people who are within an evangelical world, but have questions or misgivings about how they see the Bible typically treated in the evangelical world. So that's what we're going to look at today, and I really want to make something clear at the outset here. This is not a slam against evangelicalism or evangelicals. I mean, I have my strong disagreements, but this is not an attempt to score some points or something. I'm just talking about issues that I know are on people's minds. I know many evangelicals who are actually very flexible with many of these issues, so much so that one could rightly question their evangelical status if there is such a thing. But for people who, you know, normal people in the church who are thinking about their faith and how the Bible fits in with it, there are some things that just keep coming up. And we need to have vocabulary and concepts and a lot of honesty and I think also humility in talking through some of these issues that just keep coming up and won't go away. It causes a lot of pain, a lot of cognitive dissonance for people, sometimes a lot of shaming.
Let's talk microdosing, as you'd expect from a Bible podcast. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
And you know, microdose gummies are good for so many things like anxiety, workflow, sleeping, and stuff like that. I mean, Jared, we've had people in our lives that have benefited from this too, not just us.
Yeah, I have a family member who regularly uses microdosing for more creative, like recreational time. At time, they journal every night and it's sort of a way to unwind and do the journaling. And that's worked really well for them.
Our producer. It's made such a difference, folks. I can't even tell you that. So anyway, and for me as well, microdose gummies helped me a lot with anxiety and sleep and just stopping that racing mind at night. And it helps tremendously. I get a good night's sleep. So get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com. Promo code normal people. It's available nationwide.
That's microdose.com, promo code normal people for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code normal people.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Here's where the problem arises. You have the Bible, which of course is very important to the evangelical movement, as it has been for a very long time. This Bible is God's word to us. It informs us of things like what God is like and what we're supposed to do as people of faith. And this word of God to us that informs us, that gives us information about God and about faith and about life, is for evangelicals also inerrant. And I'm not going to be talking about that word very much. We have podcasts on that. And again, this is not slam time, but it's inerrant. And people who believe in inerrancy, they do so in very different ways. There are extremes. There's a hyper-literalistic way, and there are other ways that are more nuanced and make room for all sorts of complexities, which I think is a step in the right direction. But what makes this Bible such a problem is the expectations placed on it, because it's God's word to us that informs us and doesn't make any mistakes. Because it's God's word, it can't, right? So this tension arises from that expectation and from one simple fact. which is undeniable. Everyone would agree with this. But I think it's the fact that makes those expectations so difficult to hold on to. And it's simply this: the Bible's antiquity. It is a very, very old book. And I never grow tired of saying that because it's true. And it's almost the first thing that we really have to come to terms with when we start studying it and asking questions about its meaning for us and things like that. I mean, this is a book that comes to us from the Iron Age, which is an archaeological period which begins around 1200 BCE. And that's a long time ago. You know, if you go backwards in time to 1200 BCE, that's a lot of years. And if you take that same amount of time and go forwards, you're like past the year 5000 of our era, 5000 AD or 5000 CE. That's a long time, folks, you know, and it was a different world. This was not a Western world. This was an ancient, tribalistic, largely desert or wilderness dwelling part of the world. And they thought about the world and life and God or the gods in ways that reflect that time period. That is, to me, almost the precipitating fact that leads to all sorts of other kinds of challenges that really, they just don't mesh well with how evangelicalism typically approaches the Bible. At least that's my opinion. Right, I've written about this and talked about it. This is nothing new if you know anything about the stuff that I've done. But that's my point of view. And I want to talk about it, again, not to, boy, evangelicalism is stupid or something like that. It's more, I know there are people listening who are sort of on the cusp of saying, you know, I like my community. I don't know if I can stay here, but maybe I'm just going crazy and liberal or something like that. And I just want to say you're not. You're actually noticing things that people have been noticing for a very, very long time. At least, you know, a few hundred years in some cases, and even longer. What we might need to do is think about what the Bible is like based on how it behaves, rather than based on what we might bring into it, based on our own doctrinal needs or theological needs, and sort of just let the Bible be the Bible. And there are some characteristics of its antiquity that don't sit well. Let me put it that way, that just don't sit well with conventional ways of thinking about the Bible within the evangelical movement. And to me, that is really quite, forgive me, it's obvious to me. I could be wrong. I'm saying to me, it's obvious. So, for example, I have 5 points. First point, the antiquity of the Bible creates some things there that are morally objectionable to us. And we shouldn't shy away from that or think there's something wrong with us for even bringing these things up. For example, the number one issue is violence. I've talked about this, and we've had several podcasts about this, and I have tons of blog posts about this. I won't repeat all this stuff. But the violence in the Bible that is committed by God or done by God, either towards Israel's enemies or towards Israel for disobedience, is quite striking. It's especially striking for Christians today, I think, after 9/11. Where, you know, one of the things that Christians would say about Islam is that, my goodness, what a violent religion, and boy, we're glad Christianity is not like that. But then people say, well, just read the Bible, for heaven's sake. You know, by the time you get to chapter 6, everybody dies of Genesis, you know, it's just like, come on. There are a lot of things in the Bible that are morally objectionable around violence, the flood, the Canaanite issue of driving out the Canaanites, exterminating the Canaanites. Even though, even within the Bible itself, that is not actually an extermination because Canaanites remain, you still have the rhetoric of violence, of what God is capable of doing. The death sentence to Israelites for all sorts of things that aren't good things to do, but is there no other way forward than to punish by killing? So you have these morally objectionable things. The assumption of the legitimacy of slavery in both testaments, I might add. You know, today we don't believe, at least I hope we don't believe, that human beings can be owned by others. But yet this is the way it is. And in part because it's the ancient world and you don't have a middle class, you have rulers, and then you have people who are trying to get by, but some people wind up not being able to get by. And so they have to enslave themselves to other Israelites. It might be a matter of survival, but still, oh Lord, how about overturning the economic system so we don't have to have people who are indentured servants for their entire lives in some cases. And of course, you know, topics that people talk about all the time, like the role of women in the Old Testament, is something that is difficult for a lot of women to accept. And I get it. Boy, do I get it. I mean, women have these moments in the Bible. You know, they're the witnesses to Jesus' resurrection. They are, you know, in the case of Deborah in the Old Testament, she's a warrior, and a few other examples like that. But by and large, women tag along and are included under things that God says to men. You know, what's the covenant sign of the Old Testament that binds Israel to its God? And that is circumcision, which obviously is male circumcision. It's talked about quite explicitly. What about the women? Well, they're connected to a man. They're attached to a man. They have their identity to a man. You know, this is just the way it is. You know, and virgins are, they're basically property, you know, of their fathers. And, you know, if they're captured, they're sort of divvied out among the people. This is even in the book of Numbers. This is not the most encouraging stuff in the Bible. There are morally objectionable things that Christians today would not tolerate in society. And I'll even say this, in civilized society. And that when we see them in other religions, we criticize them as being wrong. And yet our Bible does it. So this is a problem. This is not a make-believe thing like, hey, let's problematize the Bible for no reason. This is a problem. The moral issues and much of the history, I'm going to stick with Christianity, or much of the history of Christian thought has been about trying to work that out. I think especially the violent stuff. Okay, so there are things that are morally objectionable in the Old Testament because of its antiquity, also theologically objectionable. There are things that the Bible does that if we were to hear pastors say, we would say, oh, dude, you need to go back to seminary or just read the Bible because you would not come up with stuff like this. For example, a big one that once I saw this, it just permeates the entire Old Testament, really, and not the New. Because a lot of things happen in the New with Second Temple Judaism, so I'm going to leave that out of the picture here. But in the Old Testament, the thing that really struck me is the assumption of the presence of many gods, a very active divine sphere. And I know, again, for all these things, I can say that evangelicals have answers to these, but those answers always strike me as being a bit ad hoc, which is a nice way of saying sort of made up to protect a system. Or sort of minimize the problem and say it's not that big of a deal, this is just antiquity, blah, blah, blah. But again, that's my point. It is antiquity. Therefore, bringing these kinds of things into our world is very difficult. It causes cognitive dissonance. It makes us think we're reading a fairy tale. You know, one God among many gods. Yahweh is not the only divine being. There are many. They're in competition. Yahweh gets jealous if the Israelites follow other gods. He doesn't say, listen, idiots, there are no gods. God says, don't worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Don't do that. But so much of the Old Testament theology really gets its energy from Yahweh telling the Israelites to worship him exclusively and not the gods of other nations. And if we miss that, I think we're going to miss some of the theology, but my goodness gracious, I thought our Bible was supposed to tell us what God is like. And yet, it's giving us this God who's in competition with other gods. Yeah, sure, he wins. Most of the time he wins, not all the time. Here's an example of God not winning. This is in 2 Kings chapter 3, which is a great story, but it gets buried because it's, let's face it, it's in 2 Kings. But this is a story of King Mesha of Moab. And Moab is on the other side of the Jordan River, and this is like the 9th century. And at this point in history, the northern nation of Israel, because the split had happened already a couple hundred years or so earlier, the northern nation of Israel is in control over Moab, and Mesha rebels, and the king of Israel will not allow this. So he gets a coalition together with him, the southern king, Jehoshaphat, and then the king of Edom, and they attack. And they pin Mesha into a city, and he, in a desperate attempt to push back this threat to him, he sacrifices his son on the city wall, meaning he sacrificed his son to his god Chemosh in hopes that this would convince Chemosh to go to battle for him and win. And the story ends that a great wrath fell upon Israel, and they fell back. End of story. No explanation. Do you see that, right? This is remarkable from a modern point of view that this sacrifice of a child, according to the biblical writer, actually worked. And what do we make of it? Really? Well, that might just be the impression of the biblical author. We'll get back to that. That so much of this seems to be the perceptions and understandings of ancient people. But, you know, this writer didn't need to explain that to his readers. Yeah, I guess, you know, Chemosh won this round. Now, the writer probably doesn't think that Chemosh is more powerful than Yahweh, but he doesn't explain why Yahweh doesn't fight back and counter this move somehow and explode these myths of other religions by making this sacrifice ineffective, right? That would have been a great evangelistic tool. Hey guys, the child sacrifice thing won't work. Yahweh's going to win anyway. Lay down your arms. This God that you worship isn't worth it. In fact, he probably doesn't even exist. Doesn't happen because we're in an ancient world and you get these theologically objectionable things. You know, theology proper, which means, you know, the study of God. Statements of God that are just hard for us. What do we do with this? How do I bring this into my life, right? That's the problem. And if you're taught that the Bible is sort of this seamless or essentially seamless instructional book about what God is like, which is, I'm going to submit, that is very common in evangelicalism, even if it's not stated that way, you're going to have problems with stuff like this. Another quick example of something that's theologically objectionable is this reward and punishment idea that is especially in Deuteronomy and some other places, but obedience brings blessing and disobedience brings very swift punishment, including being excommunicated or executed, right? That is sort of morally objectionable, but it's also theologically objectionable. What kind of a God are we dealing with? And especially when we come to the New Testament and, you know, Jesus does something to just stop that, right? And the question is, well, why not earlier? Why do we have these stories from this ancient Iron Age where God really acts like a touchy sovereign, prone to violence, and you don't quite know what he's going to do next? And disobedience is not simply forgiven because God is good, but it is swiftly punished. And if you don't feel that, I just suggest read Deuteronomy and really focus on the chapter on cursings towards the end, like in 28 and 29. It just hits you like a ton of bricks. And then you compare that with other notions in the Bible, and you see, like, my goodness gracious, they're not even all on the same page, which actually brings us to the third issue that comes up when you take this antiquity seriously and what this antiquity produces in the Bible. Namely, there is a lot of diversity in the Bible. There are contradictions in the Bible. Why? Because these books are written at different times, different places, by different people, under different circumstances, for different reasons. You've got a book, the Old Testament itself, which spans, for argument's sake, roughly about a 1,000-year period of time in terms of its writing, not in terms of its, you know, the topics that it covers, because it goes back to the patriarchs and creation, but in terms of its writing, probably around 1200 BC, again, is the earliest we have, because Hebrew, as we know it, almost certainly did not exist before that time. And so from 1200 to, you know, sometime before the time of Christ, maybe a couple hundred years, Daniel is usually considered to be a second century BCE document, and it certainly seems to be. You know, you got about a 1,000-year period of time, and to expect everyone to see everything about the ultimate mystery of the universe, God, and life and faith, to see it all exactly the same way, folks, that to me is a bizarre logic. That simply, it doesn't make any sense, and it certainly doesn't square with how the biblical text acts, how it behaves. You have tremendous diversity. You have, I mean, for example, we just talked about the reward and punishment theme of parts of the Old Testament, but then you have other parts that challenge that. And I'm so glad they do. You know, things like lament psalms challenge this reward system. For example, Psalm 73, one of my favorite psalms, this psalmist is beside himself because he doesn't understand how it can be that the wicked prosper while the righteous suffer. And he gets that from just probably the common ideas of the Bible. It's already stated in Psalm 1. There are two kinds of people, the wicked and the righteous. The righteous prosper, the wicked are blown away like chaff in the wind. So which do you want to be? Well, I want to be on the righteous side. But then you have Psalms saying, we are. And you've got people who are wicked who are prospering tremendously. This seems wrong. So what you have in the Bible is actually a debate, not just a dialogue, but a debate with lament psalms. They lament because they lament that God is not coming through on God's promises, that God is not just or faithful. Read Psalm 89, the whole thing. When you get to the end, it becomes pretty clear that the psalm writer is exposing God, at least in his mind. He's exposing God as someone who does not keep his promises. Why? Because you promised a son of David would always be sitting on the throne in Jerusalem, and then we have the exile with the end of the Davidic monarchy.
We're sorry to interrupt the podcast, but we want to take 1 minute to mention two simple ways to support the work we do with the Bible for Normal People. First, head to iTunes, rate us, and give us a review, but only do this if you like us. If not, go ahead, ignore this message and make baby Jesus cry. See if we care. But secondly, check us out on Patreon. Patreon.com/TheBibleForNormalPeople. There you'll find ways to jump into the community, join that discussion, and offer your support at various levels. And last but not least, we want to give our deepest thanks to some of the members of our producers group. These folks give us a lot of feedback through email, calls, and overall just help make the podcast what it is. So thanks to Matt Sutton, Martin Breithaupt, Megan Clark, Eric Hendricks, Daniel Mosberg, Danny Tanner, Dustin Balcom, Joshua Anthony, Bruce McGuire, and Sherry Jones. We couldn't do what we do without you, so thanks so much.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever.
I was worried about talking about fast-growing trees on here because I'm not a green thumb, but then I realized that probably makes me the perfect candidate to be able to talk about this. I loved the website. It was so easy. It was searchable by region. And then the experts who are there to help you make the decisions lowers the anxiety around something I don't typically know a lot about, but it was a really good experience.
This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on selected plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout.
That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code NORMALPEOPLE. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply.
A calling is a powerful thing. It's a very strong belief that there is something bigger for you. It's about who you are and where you're going in life. You may be in college, you may be halfway through a career, but you want something different.
There's a place for you at Union Presbyterian Seminary, where students are prepared for a call to ministry. At Union, you will find a diverse community. You'll find students from different denominations and professors who will listen to you and challenge you. You'll find people who help you find your own path.
You'll find a school where financial realities matter. Union offers generous financial aid, and it meets you where you are with 3 different platforms for learning: residential, online, and hybrid.
You'll find a world-class faculty who will invest in you, a community long after you graduate that supports you and equips you for service and for leadership. Safwat Marzouk, who has been on the podcast here on The Bible for Normal People, is a faculty at Union Presbyterian Seminary and is slated to write one of our upcoming commentaries. It's no secret, if you're a listener to the podcast, how much Pete and I have relied on our seminary education and how much that has shaped our view of the world and all of our work here at The Bible for Normal People.
It's your call. Respond with Union Presbyterian Seminary. To learn more, go to upsem.edu or email admissions@upsem.edu.
Now back to the podcast.
So this is a psalmist getting in God's face, right? Or, of course, the book of Job. The book of Job challenges this whole notion of reward and punishment, right? He's suffering tremendously. He's lost everything except for his own life. And his friends at first are great. They come next to him and they're quiet and they sort of suffer along with him. These are good friends. But then they start basically getting biblical with him. And they say, listen, dude, I don't know what you did, but it must have been something. And Job says, I didn't do anything. And they say, yeah, you probably did, because God doesn't punish for nothing. And Job says, maybe, but I didn't do anything. I don't deserve this. And his friends say, yes, you do. And Job says, no, I don't. And Job's friends say, yes, you did. And then Job says, maybe I did something. No, wait a minute. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve to be punished like this. And Job's friends, you know, we tend to fault them as like being like really unfaithful, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, nobody knows what's going on behind the scenes. They only know this guy's suffering. And there's this biblical motif that says disobedience leads to suffering and punishment. So if you're suffering, ipso facto, you must have done something. Job's friends are well within their biblical right to say what they say. But at the end of the book, see, this is the great part. The beginning of chapter 42, God speaks to one of the friends and says, you have not spoken of me what is right like my servant Job. You know, this book is all about the necessity of pushing back on a major biblical theme of reward and punishment. And don't get me started on Ecclesiastes. Same thing. This guy is just having a major faith crisis because the world does not make sense the way he was taught it. In fact, God is sort of difficult to stomach sometimes. God has made things crooked and you can't make it straight. That's in chapter 1. That God has set up the world in such a way to frustrate humanity. That's chapter 3. He goes on and on like that. See, this is a beautiful thing, I think, on the Word of God in the Bible. I think this is a great thing to have these counter-testimony elements, as Walter Brueggemann calls them, to not allow that other perspective to be the only one, but to have this perspective that challenges that. It doesn't just balance it. Like, hey, guys, don't let that other part get out of hand too much. It actually challenges it at its deepest root. This is a fundamental pushback against a key element of Israel's main story. If you obey, things are going to go well. If you disobey, you're going to die, which is really a metaphor for exile. And the people push back. And all of those books, Lament, Psalms, Job, Ecclesiastes, are speaking in light of the exile and questioning that logic and saying it doesn't work. You also have diversity and contradictions in laws, and to start down that path would probably take too much time here, but you know, you have laws in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and oftentimes they are very consistent or generally consistent, but at other times there are major challenges in reconciling different kinds of laws, which I think, again, is a marvelous thing about the Bible that, you know, when scribes were compiling the Bible as we know it today, after the exile, and they were deciding, I think it's quite, we're justified in saying that, they were compiling this Bible, and they were aware of this kind of diversity in the legal matter, but they kept it all anyway because this is a part of their diverse tradition. See, we're actually seeing in this Bible examples of how people at different times in different places heard God's word. I can't recommend enough to you the work of Benjamin Summer. He was on our podcast in season 1, and he just makes some great points about this diversity. And we could go on and on. I just don't want to do that here. But a good place to go, if you're wondering about this, is, and I recommend this all the time, but the Jewish Publication Society, the Study Bible, called the Jewish Study Bible. And in that, you can read the footnotes to Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And wherever there are these tensions and contradictions, the editors who wrote these notes will bring it up. It seems to be something that Judaism is more comfortable dealing with than some elements of Christianity, but there you have it. And another huge example of diversity is these two stories of Israel in the Old Testament, Chronicles versus Samuel Kings, these two very different stories about the monarchy and landing into exile and why that happens. And there are two very, very different takes. And the reason they're different takes is because Chronicles is written well after the return from Babylonian exile, where they're asking different kinds of questions. They're asking questions of whether God is still with us and whether we're still the people of God and things like that. Whereas Kings is asking the question, what did we do to deserve this? Ah, this is what we did, false worship. And our Kings led the way. Chronicles has a very different take. And so I love the fact that we have these two as if God is knocking on our head saying, pay attention, folks. You've got two stories you can't reconcile. They're not meant to be reconciled. They have different theologies because they're written at different times, places, for different reasons, under different circumstances. It's like two sermons for two different populations and who need to hear two different words of God. And the Bible bakes that into its pages. I think that's just tremendous. Okay, two more. Another thing about the antiquity of the Bible, we're going to bring the New Testament into this, and this is sort of my soapbox hobby horse topic, but it's the one that changed everything for me 30 years ago when I started thinking about this and studying it, and that is how the New Testament uses the Old Testament. And there is simply no question, folks, this is the big one, okay? I think this is really as big as any of the others. This is the big one, how the New Testament writers read the Old Testament and how they bring it into the story of Jesus and the story of Christian faith. How they do that is generally looked upon when evangelicals do some of the same kinds of things. In other words, the New Testament writers are very creative, and they simply absolutely do not stick, at least generally speaking, they don't stick to what that story meant originally in the Old Testament, but they transform it and they morph it and they sort of adjust it, let's say, to bring it into this gospel story. Again, forgive me, I say this a lot, but I've podcasted about this. If you want to listen to my podcast on Romans, I mentioned that as one of the things that Paul does in the book of Romans, but it's all over the place. When Matthew says, out of Egypt I called my son, talking about Jesus as an infant coming out of Egypt after Herod dies and the Holy Family comes back, and he's quoting Hosea 11:1, and this is fulfilled prophecy. And in Hosea, it's not a prophecy at all, but it's a look back at God calling, quote, his son, Israel, out of Egypt, in other words, out of slavery. You begin to see that these are creative, theologically driven uses of the Bible. And that always raises the question of subjectivity. Like, if they're not going to stick to what the author intended, they can just say anything they want to. That's like the worst thing you can say about biblical interpretation in the evangelical world, subjectivity. You've got to stick to the grammar and the original intention. So this is called the grammatical historical method of interpretation. Look at the words. What do the words mean in context? And how would people have understood this historically? Which is a great idea. The only problem is that the New Testament authors don't do it. As I like to quip, you know, Paul couldn't get a job teaching Paul in a seminary that taught me about Paul, because Paul is a problem. Paul has to be massaged. The gospel writers are problems for how they use the Old Testament. And to me, this was the big wake-up call that, my goodness gracious, whatever this Bible is doing, it's simply not fitting the system very well. It's not fitting the expectations I was given about what this holy book does. And for me, that's been forever liberating. It took some getting used to. I'm not going to say it. That's not the case, but you know, it's still a challenge, and it is liberating at the same time. More than anything, this is the issue that drove me to expect the Bible to be surprising and not sort of like a textbook or a rule book. I use that analogy a lot, where God is sort of like a helicopter making sure we have all the information. Helicopter parent, you know, making sure we have all the information. But this is a book that is, it takes effort to try to understand what it's doing and why it's doing it. And I, again, at my point in my walk of faith, to me, this is wonderful and amazing and encouraging, because life is like that too. Okay, the last point. Did I say the previous point was like the most difficult thing? This might be, this rivals it. And this is not new to, I'm sure, almost anyone listening to this episode. But it has to do with historicity. And that's just a fancy word that means, did things happen? And this has been the problem for at least Christian theology throughout the modern period. And I'm talking about going back to like the 1600s with people like Spinoza, the philosopher, and others who began questioning the historical value of the Old Testament. And that only got more difficult once the advent of geology and other sciences, like in the 1700s, and then biblical archaeology and other sort of scientific advances in the 19th century. it became a real problem, this relationship between the text and what the text says and the history behind it, which is, it is a problem. I mean, don't let anybody kid you. This is not like, nothing to see here, move along. No, this is a problem because the Christian faith, as Judaism, are clearly historically connected. They're saying something about history. And yet what they say about history is oftentimes very problematic for our ears. And not because, you know, we don't believe in miracles or something like that, just internal evidence, right? Chronicles versus Samuel Kings, or four Gospels, right? Things like that. These are problems. And in the Old Testament, since we're really, that's our focus today, the Old Testament, the big question there of historicity is a broad one, but it has to do with Israelite origins. Again, not to advertise too much, but we had a podcast in season one with Kent Sparks, who that was the whole topic was Israelite origins. This remains the biggest challenge for at least modern scholars looking at history in the Old Testament. It's not so much the divided monarchy or the Babylonian captivity. Of course, there are historical challenges there, but Israelite origins remains a deep, deep mystery. But one thing biblical scholars are almost certainly totally agreed on, except for those of a much more conservative bent, and that is that the way the Bible portrays Israelite origins is probably more in the line of legend or exaggeration of deep historical memories and not really a historical account. In other words, the history of the Old Testament is told to us by much later storytellers and not historians in our sense of the word. And things begin to get really difficult historically for us as we read the Bible once you get before the divided monarchy. And not to geek out too much, but from about the time of Omri, one of the main kings, if not the main king of the northern kingdom, we're in the 9th century here, folks. Once you go backwards from him, things get murky. Why? Because it's with Omri and the 9th century that we begin to see real overlap between the biblical stories and the stories of other people from the ancient world, like the Assyrians. And these are things that were discovered, have been discovered, and are being discovered through the work of some wonderful people, biblical archaeologists. So you have, from the time of Omri on, extra-biblical, meaning outside of the Bible, extra-biblical correspondence to things. They don't tell the stories the same way. They definitely have different opinions, but names are there. And, you know, we have evidence of Israelites living in Israel. We have what's called material culture. We have all sorts of things we can look at and dig into, literally. But when you move back before that time, even the time of Solomon before that, and David, things begin to get very murky because the story as it's told there in like 2 Samuel and the beginning of 1 Kings with David and Solomon, it seems rather exaggerated. It seems like this is already a distant memory. And if you go back further from that, the time of the Judges and the time of the Exodus, I mean, the writer of Exodus doesn't tell us who Pharaoh is, which is really unusual because you get names of kings all over the place after the time of Omri, but we don't know who this Pharaoh is. And it seems to be an exaggerated story of probably slaves who left Egypt, and eventually this developed into what we call Israelite religion, and that's a very complicated issue. Again, some podcasts on that. But, you know, this is a time in Israel's story that, from an archaeological and historical point of view, is very, 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 very murky. And then you move further back to the enslavement in Egypt, and then to the so-called patriarchal or the ancestral period with Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob and all their families. And it just doesn't read like history. See, this is the thing that people struggle with. And, you know, who was writing this stuff down? And the words that are in these people's mouths, where do they come from? Were people taking notes as they were talking? Or are they people? Or do they represent Israel at an early stage? A lot of thinking has been done about how the stories of Genesis, for example, and the patriarchs look like moments or episodes from the time of the monarchy later on. Like Jacob and Esau not getting along. Well, that's like Israel and Edom not getting along later on. I mean, that's a big story. If you want to read about that, search that on my blog. I have a few things about that story.
Sick of being upsold at gyms? My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
But you see, the thing is that the further back in time you go, it seems the less connected you are to history, at least as we know the term. Even the, let's say, propagandistic or biased history of 1st and 2nd Kings or Ezra and Nehemiah, it's still dealing with something that's verifiably history from a modern point of view. But going back further, the further back you go, the more difficult it is. And this has been, I think, the problem of the Old Testament for anyone who's expecting it to tell us what happened. It may be more telling us how people wanted to understand certain events and not how things actually happened. Now, I know I just set off a bomb, and I know some listening might, Pete, that's definitely not true. That's fine. You know, we can disagree on this. But the problem of history and the text, the relationship between text and history, between the Bible and history, is, I would say, the perennial problem of the modern period with the Old Testament that has caused more trouble and more challenges for people than I think probably any other. Because we might have to come to terms with the fact that the Bible is not there to give us historical information, but maybe there for other reasons. Now, let me repeat. For each of these, I know some are listening, and I don't blame you for this. You're thinking, yeah, well, I had a teacher that said this, and these things are explained, blah, blah, blah. Every problem, every challenge that I've talked about here is one that has been, let's say, addressed by conservative scholars, addressed and for some people effectively put to rest. But I'm just going to say this, that I mentioned this briefly before. There are responses, but they're more driven by an ad hoc need to retain something of the expectations of the Bible that we have. In other words, the doctrinal expectations. And that's usually centered on some form of inerrancy, either the very strict kind or even the more flexible kind of inerrancy. This ad hoc nature of the responses are ones that you would only come up with if you need to. That's sort of what an ad hoc explanation is. Now, let's be very clear. You know, people who aren't evangelicals and scholars, they have their biases too. But those biases are really not driven by doctrinal needs. They might be driven by, I need to get tenure and I have to defend my position, right? Or something like that. Or, you know, they assume a worldview, as the evangelicals like to say, where God isn't in it. Okay, fine. But how are they looking at the data? And are these people who are really driven by this hatred for God and wanting to put Jesus in his place or something, or are they just driven by what they see? You know, you can say the same thing about, let's say, Chronicles and Samuel Kings, the differences between them. I'm saying their differences are irreconcilable. And I've been told by people, well, you just have sin in your heart and you don't believe in God enough to see how these things come together. And my response is, I'm just reading this as best as I can. And I think if these two stories are there as a challenge by God to have enough faith to cram them together, I mean, I'm not even sure how to read the Bible anymore at that point. Right, so it's not just having faithless or atheistic presuppositions. It's really just trying to deal with the data as best as we can, which is why very often evangelical responses to these problems, they just sound like special pleading. So much so that evangelicals themselves are not convinced, and they wind up, this happens all the time, folks. People go to graduate school and they do their work and they come out, they're not evangelical anymore. They were sent there by evangelicals, but they learn stuff and they have trouble staying within that fold. It's not because they're faithless or weak-kneed, it's because they see the point. I can tell you, you know, for myself, within 2 months of being in graduate school, I began really looking at Genesis, especially the stories of Abraham, etc., and saying, it's quite possible that they're not people. And what do I do with that? What kind of a Bible do I have here? But see, within 2 months, and I'm not actually a pushover, you know, when it comes to learning new things. I mean, I try to be a serious student. I try to be reasonably intelligent and skeptical about things. But if my way of looking at things could be overturned, at least begin to be overturned within 2 months, what kind of a system are we dealing with here? See, that's why I think we really need to think differently about what the Bible is and not come to it with expectations of it being inerrant or perfect or giving us flawless information about God or anything else. I would rather, and I say this in The Bible Tells Me So, this is sort of the big part of this of that book, I would rather think of the Bible, at least at this point, at least as a starting point for discussion, not saying the whole thing, but at least at this point, to look at this Bible as modeling for us our own journeys of faith, where we struggle with God or we ask questions of God, but an authentic expression of faith. You know, I don't think the Israelites are just making stuff up because, you know, they're nominally religious. I think they're processing their own experience of God through the only language they have, and that changes over time. That's why you have this diversity in this ancient book. And I think that's a wonderful model, a reflection for us today, as like, my goodness gracious, you know, when I want to argue with God or when I feel despondent or when I feel joyful, I can see these things in this biblical story itself. And in that sense, I connect with it very deeply. That is how the Bible is timeless. Not because it gives us once for all information that never changes, because within the Bible, there's diversity and it changes. Rather, what makes it timeless is that we can always connect with this book. I do think of the Bible as an account, as a record of legitimate, authentic, spiritual experiences of ancient Israelites, but told in their ancient language and with their ancient thoughts in mind. And as I like to say again, and this is also in The Bible Tells Me So, that maybe the Bible looks the way that it does because God lets his children tell the story. And you might say, well, what about, I thought Revelation, I thought the Bible revealed things. Well, maybe we need to think just about what that means. Maybe it doesn't mean revealing information, like, you know, from a teacher telling students to take dictation or something like that. Maybe revelation means something else. Well, what about inspiration? I thought God inspired the authors. Yeah, well, maybe he does, but what does that even mean? That clearly doesn't mean everybody's on the same page. Maybe God is comfortable living and being expressed through the historical moments, the particularities of the people that God's dealing with. Maybe God is comfortable letting them tell the story. This is why I like the analogy. I continue to like the analogy between the Bible and Jesus. Okay, Jesus is fully and utterly human, but also divine. And I'm just going to say right off, that's a mystery. I don't understand that. I can't begin to explain it, and neither can anybody else. But you have Jesus, who's this thing that's both. And the Bible is sort of like that too. It's from God, whatever that means, but it's also completely and utterly comfortable in the various human contexts that you find it in. That's why Genesis 1, 6 days of creation, it's a mythic account. The Adam and Eve story, I feel, is a mythic account, full of theological power and insight, but nevertheless a mythic account. Just like Jesus probably had darker skin and wore a robe and sandals and learned how to use a hammer and a saw as a carpenter, right? See, Jesus is fully human, and there are certain expectations of Jesus that you would have with any human being, right? Because Jesus isn't just a person abstractly. Jesus is a person in a particular time and place. He is a first century Jew, and that first century Jewishness completely engulfs who Jesus is. It describes who Jesus is, just like I'm a white American male living in the 21st century. That's beyond dispute. I can't get out of that. For Jesus to be fully human means he can't, quote, get out of that. This is how he participates. Now, how the divine part fits in, that's a whole other issue. That's worth discussing. But my point is this. In the same way that I don't expect Jesus to step out of his humanity and stop being human for a single second, I don't expect the Bible to step out of its humanity for a single second. I expect it to be this ancient and oftentimes messy and weird book that somehow bears witness to who God is, but not in a rule book mentality. We always have to do the work to think through it. And if you have a view of the Bible that keeps you from accepting and embracing some of these challenges we talked about today, opting rather for a view of the Bible that the Bible itself, I think, really can't support, well, no wonder you're going to have problems. No wonder you're going to have cognitive dissonance. And I just want to encourage people out there who are listening, who might be themselves struggling with this or knowing people that struggle with this. is that there are and have been for a very long time, since before evangelicalism, people comfortable with this kind of diversity and accepting this challenge to take the Bible seriously enough not to flatten it out, but to sit in that mystery and in that mode of study and taking seriously this text. And I think that's what we'll do if we pay attention to what the Bible is actually doing and not pushing it to the side as an inconvenience. Okay, I could go on for 17 more hours. I won't. But thank you, folks, for listening. As always, Jared and I both, we appreciate you listening and your support of the podcast and all sorts of things like that. So thanks again, and until next time. See ya.